Dive in the Sun, written by Douglas Riemann and read by David Rintoul.
Chapter 1. The night was moonless and very dark, and the black heaving water of the Adriatic moved uneasily in an oily, sullen swell. Occasionally, the ebony waters reflected a tiny pinprick of light from one of the small stars, which seemed very high and aloof from the sea beneath, while from the invisible Italian coastline a small hot breeze clawed weakly across the dull surface. A watcher, had there been one, would have caught the briefest glimpse of a slender, stick-like object which rose rapidly out of the depths, throwing up a tiny feather of white spray as it cut through the water, like the antennae of a forgotten sea monster. The periscope vanished as suddenly as it appeared, and for a short while the sea was again empty and desolate. Then, with a surge of foam and spray, the sea was churned into a frightened torment, and the hard, streaming shape of a submarine rose gracelessly into view, the pressurized air hissing in a subdued roar as water was forced from the ballast tanks, and the disturbed waves cascaded across the canting steel hull. Within seconds, the confined space of the bridge above the conning tower was filled with silent, purposeful figures, as the lookouts carefully scanned every inch of the surrounding area with their night glasses, while on the casing below, the gun's crew stood huddled around their weapon, their hands reaching for the prepared shells and smoothing away the dampness from the controls. The officer of the watch relaxed slightly, as each man reported his horizon clear, and concentrated instead on adjusting the towel around his neck as a protection against the spray which drifted lazily over the squat bridge each time that the stem cut deep into the resisting waves. The electric motors died away and were replaced instantly by the muffled thud, thud, thud of the powerful diesels, and he felt the air being sucked down into the open hatch behind him, air to feed the engines, which in turn would feed the starved batteries. In his mind's eye, he could picture the too familiar scene beneath his feet, the relaxing grins of the seamen as they prepared to enjoy that first cigarette after surfacing, the watchful eye of the first lieutenant as he studied the compass and passed his curt orders to the coxswain, the metallic clatter of countless pieces of intricate machinery, and the gleam of subdued lighting reflecting against the brass dials and greased periscopes. He stiffened automatically as another figure clambered over the hatch combing and took his place beside him. The captain glanced perfunctorily through his glasses and checked the lookouts before he squinted at the luminous dial of his watch.
"Just about time, pilot," he said at length. "She'll be popping up any second now."
They trained their glasses over the rear of the bridge, their eyes straining against the darkness and trying to peer beyond the green and blue phosphorescence which danced crazily around the submarine's wake. There was a strange air of tension on the bridge, and as the seconds ticked past, each man felt a rising edge of alarm. Then, as they waited, the dark water took on a more definite shape, and slowly and painfully, the blurred outline of another craft rose quietly above the white track of their wake. Occasionally, the tow line tautened and whipped angrily above the wave crests, and the other craft would veer round unhappily before being brought under control by its hidden helmsman. The captain chuckled quietly.
"Well, there she is. Our midget submarine is still with us."
He spoke lightly, but the other officer had watched him closely during the last 6 days and had seen all too clearly the immense strain on his captain's thin face. 6 days of bitter anxiety as they had towed the tiny submarine and its deadly cargo across the war-torn Mediterranean, from Malta around the heel of Italy and steadily northwards up the hostile waters of the narrow Adriatic. And now, nearly 400 miles along the Italian coastline, his responsibility was practically over. It would soon be time to drop the tow and leave the little 50-foot miniature of his own boat to carry on with its dangerous mission. He paused at the top of the hatch.
"Call me the second you sight anything," he said unnecessarily. "And watch the tow line. We don't want anything to go wrong now."
He clattered down the shiny ladder to the control room, brushing past the next group of lookouts, who stood, their eyes covered with dark glasses and smoking beneath the hatch like a collection of blind men, and walked tiredly across to his first lieutenant.